This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 1st of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
You know, if the court will call me for whatever kind of request, information, investigation, I will be ready. I have no problem.
Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki after the ceremony which saw the Palestinian Authority joining the International Criminal Court. Justice activists hail this as an opportunity to bring accountability as the conflict between Palestinians and Israel continues. Isabel Hilton and Robert Fox will be here to discuss this and some of the other news stories of the day, including a great wall of sand as China builds reclaimed land masses in the South China Sea, continuing talks on Iran's nuclear future, and the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi's ambitious reform agenda. All that up for discussion on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, here on Monocle 24. Just 1 minute past 1800 hours here in London, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. My guests are regular Monocle contributors, the journalist and broadcaster Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Robert Fox, the defence editor at London's Evening Standard newspaper. We'll start today's programme in China and its territorial claims on the South China Sea. A top US official has warned that China's land reclamation in the region is cause for serious concern. China's currently building artificial land by pumping sand onto live coral reefs and paving over them with concrete. According to the Admiral, China's now created over 4 square kilometres of artificial landmass. Isabel, come to you first of all. It's been described perhaps inevitably as the construction of a great wall of sand, which is a headline writer's dream, undeniably.
But at least it didn't have dragon in it.
what is China trying to achieve here? We've discussed the controversy surrounding claims on this sort of part of the world. What's your reading of the situation?
Well, I think it's all, you know, this sort of salami progress in pursuit of the nine-dash line, which is the line by which China claims pretty much all of the South China Sea, clearly disputed. Now, you might think that building an airstrip on top of a piece of coral would create an island, but in international law, it doesn't. I mean, a rock is still a rock under UNCLOS. It doesn't give it any greater established rights to maritime territory. But it does create somewhere where you can land a warship. And I mean, land an aircraft or dock a warship. And obviously China's neighbours are concerned about that. None of them have the kind of nautical hardware that can stand up to China's navy. There have been a lot of confrontations and you know, face-offs in the South China Sea. And it's seen as China is committed to a non-aggressive stance in the South China Sea under an earlier agreement, and that's clearly not what it's pursuing. So people are concerned. It's unnecessary. And if it's not about stamping all over other people's claims, what is it about?
Well, we'll talk perhaps a bit more about some of those alternative claims in a moment. Robert, I want to ask you, just from a sort of, categorising viewpoint, how would you define these sorts of disputes that we see in the South China Sea? Is it a maritime issue? Is it political? Could it be commercial? Is it a defence issue? I mean, what would you sort of label this sort of dispute, these kind of counterclaims as?
Well, as Isabel was describing it, it's almost an 18th century territorial mercantilist approach. It's sort of the war of Jenkins' ear. But I think that by saying something has historical parallels, we can't put it in a box there. I mean, look at the dispute over the Malvinas Falklands, which is a very live issue. And the great thing about them is that they do tend to have unpredictable twists and turns. I think the locus, the location of this remark by the commander of the US, why was he saying this, by the way, Pacific Fleet? Obviously, he is looking at strategic interest in the great strategic naval conference, which is now a big event in Australia. It is a hybrid issue, as you rightly say, because look at the way China is behaving in mainland Asia. I think it was one of the great unreported stories of Afghanistan, for example, how China was, in a way, in quite legitimate ways too, but quite rapacious in getting its hands on anything of mineral significance and resource, although they had allegedly plenty themselves, but not sufficient, things like rare earth elements and so on. And I do agree. I think this is a security issue. It is the way China sees its security, and it sees it very much in terms of its own regional bloc. And where have we heard all that before? But then the corollary, which you've brought up, which is, do you meet something that could turn to a hard power threat with hard power posture of your own? I think that's a big question mark, and I'm very worried about the responses of countries like South Korea and, above all, Japan to this.
Well, let's look at some of those reactions then, Isabel, as we mentioned. What do you think the response will be, in particular, to this sort of, you know, artificial landmass issue? Is it just one strand of several that provide a great deal of concern to some of these other regional players? What do you think the response is likely to be? Or will it be perhaps more of the same, what we've already seen so far?
I think it'll be more of the same. I mean, but the United States is planning to move most of its 60% of its navy back to the Pacific, because that's where it currently sees the tension. As far as the South China Sea goes, there are, of course, resources. It's very rich in fishing, oil and gas. The US challenges China's claims, not only on behalf of China's smaller neighbours, but also on a freedom of navigation question. And that's a pretty fundamental posture for the United States. So I think that if we do see challenges, we will see it over freedom of navigation. We will see the US, if the Chinese would regard it as provocative, but the US will be asserting the right to freedom of navigation and overflight in that area, I think, increasingly. And I suppose the risk, the daily risk of that kind of thing, is that you get the kind of collision that we saw in 2001 between a Chinese fighter plane and a US fighter plane. So these incidents, you know, the capture of small customs, the capture of customs boats, the capture of fishing vessels, the risk of collision, all of these do raise international tensions. And as you get this kind of small scale confrontation over a larger issue, then you do run a risk of that kind of thing happening. And it's not clear to me that we have the mechanisms in place to tone down, you know, the risk of such issues escalating. You have very inflamed feelings in over these maritime claims, certainly in the Philippines. China itself and Japan, of course, in the East China Sea, once you get angry populations, governments find it very hard to back down.
Well, that's quite interesting. And let's talk a little bit about what, you know, some resolutions might be. We know that China tends to prefer, you know, the sort of behind closed doors bilaterals rather than any sort of big international negotiations about maritime and other disputes. In fact, Robert, do you think there is any way forward in that respect? Are there chances of those sorts of discussions taking place with any of the key protagonists here? Or do you think, because of the nature of the frictions, that's just not very likely?
I think there are. And I think there is potential for quiet diplomacy, provided the participants, I think the immediate local participants who we talked about, take it very seriously indeed. Actually, if you go to serious think tanks in Britain, France, Netherlands, freedom of navigation is a big, big question for the 21st century. You wouldn't get it from looking at most of the English language prints, weeklies and dailies, produced in the UK. But when you look at the prospect of what Britain has to do, for example, to safeguard trade around the middle of the 21st century, well over 50% of all foreign commercial earnings will come by sea. More than 50% of global maritime trade will be done across the wider Indian Ocean and into the South Pacific. So it does affect everybody. There might be a terrific UN tendency, as you rightly hinted, to have a glorious round table, like, and look how the various laws of the sea negotiation, which were fraught and tangled and very difficult. But if only something can be done, which has been pretty successful, although it's had glitches, the neutralization, the non-nuclearization of Antarctica, for example, the Antarctic Treaty of 1958, is the gold standard of this. And I think it's going to require that, because it is a very crowded space, physically and intellectually, the claims there. And I think we now see it, the big marker that this puts down in this rather small pinpoint kind of way. It is a very big issue.
Isabel, what do you make of that? The notion of, you know, a role for quiet diplomacy. Could you see that happening, or and happening effectively?
Well, I can see that happening in terms of containment of risk. Yes, the kind of the hotline approach, or setting up mechanisms whereby if there is an incident and if then things don't get out of hand. What I can't see quiet diplomacy doing is settling the territorial claims, because I can't see the smaller countries backing down. And China has you know, made this claim for actually this claim predates the arrival of the communists in power. The Philippines have tried to go to international arbitration. China has been very cross with that. And the other problem with quiet diplomacy with China and its neighbours is that China is by far the largest trade partner of each of those smaller countries, so that on a bilateral basis, they're at a fairly strong disadvantage. They would therefore prefer multilateral bodies and international arbitration.
Let's leave South China Sea there and continue with the latest member of the International Criminal Court. The Palestinian Authority joined the court today with a low-key ceremony at its headquarters in The Hague. The event was attended by diplomats and officials from more than 100 countries, but not Israel, not a member of the court, of course. Becoming a member of the ICC is part of a broader effort by the Palestinians to put some international pressure on Israel. International justice activists hailed the occasion as an opportunity for some additional accountability as this conflict between Palestinians and Israel continues to rumble on. Robert, I'll come to you first of all. I guess it's instructive to look at some quotes from some of the key protagonists. We heard at the top of the show from Foreign Minister Riyad Maliki saying Palestinians are there to seek justice, not vengeance. Israel's response was that this was political, cynical and hypocritical, given it has Hamas as a partner. What's your reading? Somewhere between those two?
Well, I think it is a big step forward for the Palestinian authority. It is part of them getting into the UN process, and that is scaring Israel to death. Now, come on in a minute to the quite clear pieces of evidence for that. What it also does, which the Palestinians are quite skilled at doing, in saying that this may give us in the court of world opinion, it gives us yet another route to redress to the behavior, particularly of the Israeli armed forces, the IDF, in the various attacks, but particularly the last one, which was gruesome, in Gaza, where civilians were attacked and the targets were attacked, where it was obvious to everybody that there were civilians. This is very important. I think the Israeli reaction is understandable, but just standing back, I would say it's intemperate and probably counterproductive. There's a very emotional piece, if I can put it like that, in the op-ed of the New York Times today by Ron Prosser, which calls the UN the great betrayer. It's obviously on the back of, he could see, he's, by the way, the permanent representative of Israel at the UN, a very prominent figure in this country too. But to say that, you know, the UN is the great betrayer, whereas the UN has been so important in the recognition and the legitimization of Israel itself, I think is very, very difficult indeed. And I think that this is where it is a struggle, and I think it's part of the legacy from the surprisingly decisive win of Netanyahu in the election, where almost appeared as if they felt that they could sit on their hands as far as negotiating, of trying to get some peace process going with the Palestinians, to the extent that we had Netanyahu saying just a few days before the election there would be no recognition of a Palestinian state as long as he's around. Then he rode back on it. And he's been behaving somewhat like that since the election, by the way, going soft cop, strong cop, saying some very tough things one day, then seeming to row back on it the next. Very worried about his own Israeli Arab population. I'm worried about this in that I don't think it's changing the price of fish, in that the mood from the region, from my friends I speak to there from all sides, is that they're feeling that another serious collision over Gaza is it's barely a year or two away, and it's awful to have that feeling. And by the way, it isn't a job of a journalist to be a prophet.
No, indeed. Isabel, what do you make of this? I mean, so, people are suggesting that ongoing bids to sort of obstruct the Palestinian bid to join these sorts of bodies to get statehood recognised officially is an affront to the international pursuit of justice. But is there a degree to which there is, it's understandable pragmatism, if you like, from Israel? Netanyahu does what's politically expedient, and that's understandable. Where do you stand on it?
Well, I suppose Netanyahu's position is understandable without being admirable in any way. He has been a major obstacle to any progress in the situation for some time. And I can understand also Palestinian frustration. This is quite a high-risk move, however, because the PLA is very vulnerable to retribution, if you like. Israel withholding tax receipts, the US withholding its substantial support of the authorities. So it's quite a bold move. I think if it succeeds the advantage for the Palestinians, if you like, morally and in terms of world public opinion, is that you have a technically independent authority in the court. It's the court that investigates. It's the court that decides whether there is a case to answer. It's the court that then brings the case. So we get away, if you like, from the he said, she said situation in which each side accuses the other, and we get nowhere. The Palestinians, certainly are vulnerable to countercharges, after all, or counter-investigations, citing rocket batteries in schools, vulnerable civilian targets, hiding behind the civilian population. They have been accused of all that. There's some support, even from human rights organizations, to suggest that that may have taken place. But I think the larger weight, obviously, of suffering is on the Palestinian side. And as Robert said, the very disproportionate use of force by Israel, certainly last summer, is fairly clear. But I'm not sure how far this is going to get before there are quite serious consequences for the authority.
Just one brief thought, Robert. Israel mentioned the US there in passing, and I just wondered about where they are on all of this, particularly given where we are within the US political cycle, if you like. We talked about Netanyahu previously when he went to Washington, for example, and delivered that address, which was very incendiary. Do you think to a degree there was a miscalculation politically by Netanyahu about the response that he would get from the US? Or do you think he was probably rather happy with how that narrative played?
Well, I think he was, particularly given the reception he received from Congress, and we know who's in the majority in Congress, and so that was almost a no-brainer. But I absolutely follow what Isabel is saying. One good thing I would say about this is that it edges ever more Hamas towards the norms of legitimacy and normal legal governance. I just put it like that. On the other side, the thing that worries me, very broad brush, but I've said it on this program before, the almost siege mentality that is a reciprocal feeding process between Netanyahu and his electorate means there is less and less chance of a two-state solution. And that is what is so terrifying. It's a kind of thing a classical Marxist might have believed. There is almost a terrible feeling, given the demographic imbalance and so on, that we're facing a historical inevitability there. And that is what is so worrying. And that is the thing that Netanyahu doesn't seem to be able to heed. He may be able to hang on. The generations after him are going to have a great deal of difficulty by just saying no accommodation to the Arab populations.
Some sobering thoughts, the insights there of Robert Fox. Isabel Hilton is still with me, Tom Edwards, here on Midori House. When we come back after a short break, we'll discuss Italy's reform agenda and consider the latest developments regarding Iran's nuclear aspirations, amongst other things. Stay tuned.
In a competitive and ever-modernising world, artisan producers are staying resilient and challenging mass production. Monocle Films visits entrepreneurs in Istanbul, Cape Town and Mallorca who champion the art of craft.
The biggest focal point is how can I make this thing as hardy as possible? All these materials over time will just soften and darken and start picking up blemishes and start telling their own story.
Making a Point, premiering now in the film section of Monocle.com.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests, Isabel Hilton and Robert Fox. Let's continue now with the reform agenda that Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has for his country. The youngest Prime Minister in Italy's history, aged 40, Renzi's been unafraid to push through significant reforms that he hopes will boost the country's stalled economy. One of the loftier ambitions Renzi set is to change the Italian political structure, which has often been considered somewhat dysfunctional. Renzi wants to place most legislative powers in the lower house and transform the Senate into more of a regional body. Robert, I'll come to you first of all. I guess to mention his reform agenda would elicit varying reactions in Italy, some of whom think that he's wrong. Rather unconvincing, many of whom find him a very compelling politician with a particularly sort of compelling political narrative. Do you think he can succeed in introducing some of these changes that people are talking about?
His popularity is remarkably sustained, and it's remarkably sustained by European standards. He fights an election, wins, comes through with a difficult reform agenda, part of which has been very successful, part of which hasn't. He goes to European elections and scores an absolute knockout across Italy, gets 41% approval. I think even Angela Merkel would die for that. And that's the other thing. Let's just look at the European stage. Italy has a discrete position. It is part of the wider market of Germany, and they do fit together. Interestingly, it's the dialogue about the future of Europe that's going on between Renzi and Angela Merkel at the moment that is so interesting. It's almost as if François Hollande is in abeyance. He's in bulk, as you might say, if you're playing snooker or billiards, because he's caught by difficulties of his own economic cycle, the difficulty of the French economy, and, of course, the political cycle. But what Renzi is saying, I've got to go for growth. This thing is stuck. But Italy is true to its credential. It's always been the bloc democracy. And this is why the Senate reform is so interesting. Because by getting rid of the Senate with its present powers, which are equal to those of the lower house, you can stop all the jobbery, the backhanding, the corruption, the second guessing, and we'll be able to get legislation through. I'm sure he's going to be able to do it. But there, he's going to try and move on to getting the Italian economy moving, which is a huge, huge problem. There has been great success in some areas, but the odds are so strongly against him.
Just on that point, Robert, you make there about the Senate reforms. I mean, some of his critics suggest that he's sort of fairly subtly or unsubtly removing certain checks and balances and saying, well, of course, you know, the system can become more workable if you can make what are essentially unjustifiable changes. Do you have any truck with that position?
I don't. In principle, it's absolutely pure. In practice, it's absolute rubbish. You just look at the mischief over my working time, which is now over 50 years in Italy, to see the trouble, the mischief, these strange life senators like the extremely dubious, now no longer with us, Giulio Andreotti. They could fix. They could actually throw a spanner in the works, stop anything, because it's where a lot of very, very dubious practice took place. I just have to say that one of Berlusconi's cronies, who was a senator, Marcello Dell'Utri, who is now serving time for being mafia association, they've turned out his library and found it's full of stolen books from public libraries and ecclesiastical libraries. The stories have come out together is very important, because that's the sleazebaggery that Matteo Renzi says, you know, I've only got about 8 years, he said, I'm a young man, but my energy isn't going to last forever, and we've really got to get this place moving.
Just on the sort of pan-European picture, Isabel, it's interesting that, you know, does Renzi provide perhaps a bit of a, you know, a notional idea of how the European left, if you like, which is a bit embattled? You only have to look, as Robert mentioned, you look to France, Hollande being beaten up terribly in the regional elections. Questions in this country too about the sort of the lack of a credible sort of socialist agenda. Does he offer something of an alternative? Could he be a bit of a poster boy, or is that too much to put on his youthful shoulders?
Well, it depends what you call the left. I mean, he identifies with Tony Blair, who I think probably the Labour Party at this point would not necessarily see Tony Blair as of the left. But I think Robert's right that in reading Italian politics, you have to remember that both the both politics and the economy in Italy have operated in the shadows for so long that, that what the formal structures say and how things work are two very different things. So that if he could institutionalize government in Italy in a you know more credible sense, that would be rather wonderful. And then I might hope he might come here and help us abolish the House of Lords, which would be rather wonderful too.
Which is now becoming urgent, I think.
Yes,
actually.
So he's really got his work cut out.
He's got his work cut out. Well, when he gets tired of Italy, I think we've certainly got a job for him here.
But the great thing is, I say, watch out, sustained popularity. And he hasn't been blown off course by Tsipras and Syriac. He said they have their thing. I'm going to speak for us. And he is. He is the leader of the soft left.
But
I agree.
He's also yeah. a serious politician. He's not an insurgent in the sense that he, you know, yeah. he's come out of nowhere. He ran a major city. He's, you know, he's been around. And I think he will, it'll be interesting to watch. But I think
indeed,
he'll have an effect.
We're watching very closely. Let's move on. The clock is ticking towards this extended deadline as Iran and six world powers are pushing for a deal on the future of the Iranian nuclear program. Across the border from Italy in Lausanne, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia and China have been trying to break this impasse for nearly a week. The original deadline was yesterday. It's been pushed back. The French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov and their Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, have already left Lausanne, leaving aides to negotiate. However, diplomats insist the negotiations are making progress. Robert, is this a sort of a one-off opportunity that needs to be seized? Is that why the deadlines are passed and the negotiations continue? Because there is an acknowledgement, even tacitly, that this is an opportunity that must be grabbed, and it's sort of one time only.
It's a process that can't be stopped. It's a thread of Ariadne, you know, that you know, in order to get through the labyrinth, you mustn't break the spider's thread, you know. And I think that that is what is really going in. I think they're condemned to succeed in whatever form. And I can see what they're arguing about. And the substance, it's some of it's quite technical. It's about how much intellectual property and endeavor you're going to allow the Iranian nuclear industry and nuclear academe to go, and also how quickly you lift sanctions. It isn't about that at all. It's actually very simple, monosyllabic headlines. It's whether Iran diplomatically can break free from its isolation, the isolation of Persia. And this scares two powers absolutely to death. Israel, which I think has other things on its hand, but above all Saudi Arabia. And I think that we are going to get an agreement to disagree, but to continue very much. I think it's part of a process that people, arch pragmatists like James Baker, that sort of crew, the old sort of rather blue blood diplomatic establishment in the US, saw that this needed to be done quite a long time ago. That, I think, will continue. The consequences, though, catalyzed by what is going on in Iraq, in Yemen, in Syria. Only today, just so I came in, Tom, that Baghdad was hailing the great victory and the liberation of Tikrit. Will Tikrit be seen as another blow against the Sunni world, which is the way it's being painted, by the infidel Shias being led by the spearhead of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard? And you've got the same going on in Yemen. And you've got in the middle the most contradictory signals being sent by the US of A, at one minute supporting the Shias in Tikrit, then not, and then helping Saudi forces bomb Sana'a to get the Houthi out. I mean, it's a very, very strange thing. But by the way, it is the beginning, I think, of something very, very big. This is going to be a dominating conflict now.
Isabel, just very, very briefly, because we're almost out of time. Do you share that reading of the situation, that this is, that it could be sort of a singular moment, diplomatically, politically, geopolitically?
I do think it's a pivotal moment, but you have to set it in the context of the disintegration of the old order in the Middle East, which was set in train by the invasion of Iraq, George Bush Jr.'s invasion of Iraq. And I think it will take many years for these forces to come into any kind of stasis.
And there we must leave it. My thanks to Isabel Hilton and Robert Fox, my guests today on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Mike Hewin and Sara Moneta, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The show returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London, 1300 hours in New York. Do stay tuned. Marcus is keeping you company next with more great music from our international playlist through till 1900 hours, when you can hear The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. That's all we've got time for today's programme. Goodbye.